Thanks so much for coming. My name is Sisonke Nsemang. Before we begin, I would like to acknowledge that we are on Noongar Buja, and I would like to pay my respects to elders past and present, and of course to acknowledge those who are yet to come. I want to acknowledge too that we are on a land that is full and rich with stories, past and present as well, and that we are incredibly lucky to be on this particular Buja. So welcome to the Center for Stories, everybody. I am very happy to be part of this session. I am obviously not Marian. My name is Sisonke, so sorry for the letdown. But I hope we can have a good conversation in any case. I'd like to introduce Ron Bradfield Jr. He is a saltwater fella from Bardi Country, which is north of Broome. But he grew up in Geraldton. He now calls Wajak Buja his home. Ron has been accused of many things, but I think we can just call him a storyteller. And from our conversation that we just had now in the other room, a listener too.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So welcome, Ron, very much. So I'm not going to stay here. I'm going to sit down because this is Ron's show, and then I'll come back and we'll have a little bit of a chat after we hear Ron's yarns. So
now I'm done. I guess one of the things that you probably couldn't tell looking at me right now is, in this really colourful shirt, is that actually I spent 10 years in the Australian Defence Force. Once, a little way back when I had hair, I actually joined the Australian Defence Force, probably 1987, and spent 10 years in uniform until I left in 1997 and was returned to the world. For my sins, I was out there working with young people and sharing stories and helping people get on with stuff back out in life. But what you might not know about that was that as a young Aboriginal man growing up where I grew up and coming into this world at the time that I came into this world in 1968, was that time in uniform, 10 years in uniform for me, as a young Aboriginal man, was actually a place where I could go and was probably treated with the most equality that I've ever been treated with in my life in this world. Excuse me. I guess the irony is that I had better opportunity and better job security in a life of uniform than I've ever actually had out of it. So I played Army games first. I did that for 4 years, and then I played Navy games. And I did that for 6. I hope that adds up to 10. And I left a place called Geraldton. Probably, I could safely say, quite an angry young man. I can quite happily say now that it's probably just as well that I went to the military, because I would have probably gone to jail. The nature of the upbringing that I received as a young Aboriginal man in a town called Geraldton was that reminded me that I wasn't particularly of particular value to our Australian society. Not really. 1967, of course, was when the majority of Australians voted in the 1967 referendum that allowed Aboriginal people to be included in our census. And whilst the majority of this nation's population might have supported that kind of notion, sadly, this nation's Commonwealth and its states and territories had laws that would take many years to change and shift to allow for the fact that Aboriginal people would be treated in that particular way. My mother is a Bardi woman. My father is a Gadia man, a white man. And my father met my mother, I'd say probably in 1965, 1966, when he was sent up to Port Hedland as a baby teacher when he was 19. Fancy that. Fancy sending teachers out to be in charge of kids at 19. That's a frightening thought. And he was sent to a place called Port Hedland, a place he'd never seen before, and a world and an environment that he'd never seen before. He was a Fremantle boy. He grew up down here. And he'd never really had anything to do with Aboriginal people. He'd seen a couple in the schools that he went to, but pretty much Aboriginal people as such, they weren't a part of his life. The notions of their business weren't a part of his life. His father was a World War II veteran, and his mother pretty much controlled the nature of the world that they lived in and grew up in as children at the time. And so when he arrived in Port Hedland, he was introduced to a world that was us and them, a world that he had no idea about and really couldn't come to terms with. And it wasn't until he was probably well into his school year in that first school posting that he had, when they had their parent-teacher meeting night, that he saw a whole pile of names on his roster, on his role, teacher's role, yet only a certain number of parents came in through the door. And when he asked the headmaster about why that was, the majority of the students that were actually on his role that he'd never really had anything to do with were Aboriginal. And none of those parents were allowed into the town at night. Okay? They were still meant to be on the reserves by law at sundown. And he'd never seen such a thing. In fact, he hadn't met any of these parents and he'd hardly seen any of these kids. And so in 1966, he went, this is odd, I better go and do something about this. And he decided that he'd take that day and he walked out of town over the pipeline and into the Aboriginal reserve. And no sooner did he set his foot on the other side of the place that this older Aboriginal man stepped in front of him and said, "Oi, what are you doing here, Whitey?" And pointed at the sign that basically said, any person not having business here, not officially being here, will be fined. In pounds it was then too. And so the old guy went, "Well, what are you doing here?" And he said, "Well, I've got all these kids on my books and I've not seen any of them and I've not seen their parents and I want to know what it is that I can do. I'm the teacher. I want to know what I'm meant to be doing to help them with their education." And that old bloke just looked at him and went, "Well, that's the first time anyone's ever done that." And from that moment, things changed completely for my father. That old man said, "You better come with me." And he walked him through the reserve and he introduced him to all of the family members and the kids that were on his books. And from that day, my father did half of his teaching in the Aboriginal Reserve and half of his teaching in the classroom. And so he followed the kids around when they went following the salmon runs and when they went fishing and they went bush, and he did his teachings with them. And he went into the classroom and did his teachings with the other kids inside town. As a part of this, he tripped over my mother and they met and they entered into an illegal relationship. In fact, they were actually both being watched very closely by the local authorities. Mum was an Aboriginal woman, he was a white man. Now, he wouldn't have gotten too much strife, he might have got a smack on the wrist and told the bugger off, but my mum actually would have been deported. I don't know if you know what that might mean in a place like this, but I'll give you an example. About the same time, in Jigalong, a young girl who had a relationship with a young white man out there was actually picked up and taken by one of the nuns, and she was deported to a mission, an orphanage in Ballarat, never to come back again. And the way this world works was I then tripped over her brother 40 years later in a community that I was working in, and we found out just by accident that I'd been in Ballarat and his sister was there. And so the next time I went back, I actually took a letter for his sister, and that was the first correspondence they'd had for 40 years. That's the sort of stuff that was still going on in this country. Now, they ran away together. They were very naughty. My father got posted to Northampton and he asked my mum to marry him. And she would have had to get permission from the protectorate at the time, but didn't. And they came down to a little church in Bicton and they were married illegally in 1968. And that's when I was born. I still went through a schooling process that actually saw us as Aboriginal people separated from the non-Aboriginal kids, the white kids. That happened for the first 3 years of the school that I was in. The bell would ring and all the Aboriginal kids would have to fall in on the quadrangle, stand in line, stretch out, be in line and be inspected by the nuns and priests before we were allowed to go into the classroom. That's someone standing in front of you, making you turn your head so they can look in one ear, look in the next, open your mouth, see if you've got anything there, look you up and down, then walk around and do it again, the back of you. And then that next bell would ring, and the Aboriginal children would fall in outside of their classrooms, ready to go into their class. Now that might not have been the norm by about that time, but that was my experience. And that was a Catholic school, and about the time that I hit grade three, they were letting lay staff teach in the schools, and things suddenly changed. Nuns and priests couldn't do that anymore in the schools. But by then the damage had been done. We'd been told and taught and conditioned as to what it was that we should be as young Aboriginal people in a town like Geraldton. And pretty much most of Geraldton reinforced that one way or another. I grew up in that world. And it wasn't necessarily a positive experience. I was incredibly lucky though. I had a mum and dad who actually valued each other and valued what each person brought to the table. My father never dismissed our Aboriginality, never dismissed what came with that, and actually took his role as a member of that Aboriginal family very, very seriously. He too was army. My grandfather was ex-army. My mother had been brought up by nuns. I was conditioned by nuns. Of course I was going to go into the military. In fact, recruit school for both the Army and the Navy was incredibly easy for me. My mother had taught us well. We all knew how to iron our shirts. We knew what starch was. We even understood what a washing machine could do. Pretty remarkable, really, for teenage boys. And that's where I landed. The military made way for me in ways that probably are really hard to explain. But much like the shirt you see, what it allowed to happen was that I could put one skin over my skin and suddenly disappear. And that's what I learned at a really early age. I learned how to disappear. I learned how to not be seen as an Aboriginal boy or man, and I still do that today. The military let me be seen in a particular way that is revered in this country. If anybody says something that's anti-ANZAC, look out. You know, that's just not Australian. But of course we should be able to say those things. Of course we should be able to explore it. Of course we should be able to have these conversations. And at that time, I could hide my uniform like you wouldn't believe. But the moment I took that uniform off was when things would change. Like the moment when I stopped working for a day in what was called the Small Boats Harbour on the north shore of Sydney. And my friend Mick, he and I had stepped up and out of the base, and because it was down the north shore, it was a steep walk up and over the rocks and onto the street, and it opened out and across the road was a corner deli. Mick needed a packet of smokes, and we were in our civvies and we wandered across the corner road. Mick ducked in to grab his smokes. I don't smoke, I'm far too lazy for that. And I waited outside. And that's when I noticed the really shiny flash Mercedes-Benz that I was waiting next to. And I was looking at it just going, wow, this is really nice. And that's when the police car, screamed to a halt right next to me. And that's when the police got out of the car and I was pressed up against the wall. And that's where I was handcuffed. And that's where I was being dragged and put into the police car. Nothing asked, nothing said, just being done. When Mick stepped out of the corner deli, and it was Mick who stepped out and went, oi, what's going on? And the copper just said, bugger off, mate, it's none of your business. And Mick said, hang on, mate, have you checked his ID? And the copper said, nick off, it's not your business. We've just come off the naval base, we're sailors, have you checked his ID? And the copper sort of paused for a moment and made me fumble over while he grabbed my wallet out. Looked in, and sure enough, there's my Navy ID. unclipped the handcuffs, dragged me out of the car, threw me out, said, get on your way, you know what's going on here. Mm-hmm. And that was it. Nick saved me a night in a clink that night. And it was little things like that, bizarrely, through 10 years of the military, that let me actually realise that I could actually have some dignity in this country as an Aboriginal man. Now, there are all kinds of things I've experienced in the military. I mean, of course, the military is only ever really a reflection of the society it's based in. And it's not perfect, and it's downright cruel at times. But somehow for me, in amongst that, I discovered a whole pile of things about people and the way it is that they still try to carry their stories as they too hide inside of their other skins. So today, I actually use that experience and I help conversations happen. And I try and get people to talk about who they are, tucked away underneath that skin you might be wearing, so that you can appreciate the stories that you have and you can start to investigate who you are as you stand here on Wajak Wudja, which is your home, and be who you are in this place so your stories can join ours. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've got to forgive us. We're ringings, by the way. No, it's not.
It's true. So thanks for that, Ron. So it feels like there's a whole lot to explore, and I also want to leave a bit of time for other people's questions, but I'll kick it off. The way that you ended that recounting, which was beautiful, was in a real spirit of generosity, because you talked about your story and this idea of joining stories. And I wonder where that comes from. Where does that sense of generosity come from? Is it your parents being a child of love? Is it like because so many of the experiences of being racialized, since we're all racialized. Some of us are racialized in positive ways, some of us are racialized in negative ways. But the experience of being racialized as an Aboriginal person in this country is clearly so brutal, and you recounted a number of those incidents, and yet you land in a place of generosity. So where does that come from?
It seems to be the default position of most Aboriginal people, actually. Yeah. It's been my experience to see some of the most hardest hit of Aboriginal people in this country reach out a hand and say, come sit down here with me, share in our stories, be on this place, we would like to welcome you. Mm. My mother was certainly that. Mm. Certainly, and for me, a lot of what have been the strong figures in my life are the women, Bharati women. Mm. and Jawi and Nyunya women in and around where I come from, up at the tip of Cape Levique. Incredibly strong women who have gone through some I'm a man and I cringe when I think about some of the ways in which things were taken from women in this country and across the world. Mm. And yet these women would still hold out a hand and say, no, come sit. You're welcome. Mm. And my mother was that kind of woman. Mm. And my father was too. And what they did was they made a space become available in our house where people could come and sit, I guess, at the table and share in the story. My mother and father made space for many, many, many people over the years. Mm. And it's not, they never ever necessarily felt like they were being lectured, unless my father was on his soapbox, that was a different thing. but when they shared their story, when they talked about who they were and what that was and what they challenged to be able to raise three boys and give them some hope, that story just left the way open for others to be a part of it. And that's the place where we all should be living as Australians, and in fact, as people of this world today.
When you talk about stories, there's a way in which you talk about it that makes me think that it's beyond the kind of conventional idea that most people have of what a story is. When we were in the room before and we were prepping, you talked about this
beautiful experience of going to London. And I want you to talk about that a little bit, because I think it's such a powerful way of deepening story practice. So, okay. Yeah.
I was lucky enough to be part of an experience that saw me go to London as one of Australia's Aboriginal leaders within the arts industry, I guess. And I went under the guise of questioning arts organisations in the UK about what they were doing to allow cultural stories from the lands to be a part of how it is that they did their business when working with artists and collecting stories. Or were they telling people on the lands what to do? You know, when people were recounting their culture and their basis and their bits and pieces, was it top down or was it bottom up? But that really wasn't why I was there. I arrived and I decided that what I would do is I would stop and ask as many people that I would meet in as many different places who they were and what their story was. And I would just simply sit and make a moment occur where I engaged a complete stranger and said, "Oh, g'day, mate. My name's Ron. How are you? What's your story?" And people would tell me. I was just going about trying to find out how long it would take before someone reached back inside themselves and genuinely brought out that thing that they held on to that connected them to their place, their story, their business. And I was pleased to find that for most people I met, about 3 to 5 minutes it took before someone shared a part of themselves and actually went click. And then suddenly we were connected and we're having this really intimate and, I guess, surprising moment. And then we would thank each other and go on our way.
Mm.
Yeah, stories are incredibly important. And I think one of the things I find that I struggle with most here in Australia is that so many Australians struggle to understand that their story too is of this place and that you belong here. And stories are just many layers. This is Wadjuk Budjo. You've got, 60,000, 80,000 years worth of stories in this place, and yours sits right on top of all of that.
Mm.
And it can't be erased.
Mm.
It's pretty incredible.
It is incredible. I do a lot of storytelling, and often when I'm dealing with white fellas in particular, feel that they don't want to share their stories. They feel as though coming from a place of good intentions often want to privilege other stories, and I never allow that to happen. I insist that everybody has a story to share, and I wonder what you think is happening when someone, even for good reasons, is saying that they don't want to share their story. What is that about?
I guess when I've sort of come to discover it, I feel like Australians are being forced to buy a line. You know, here's your given history, and this is who you are, and this is how you arrived, and this is why you're in this place. Amen. And it's so much more than that. No, this is my mother. My mother came from such and such. This is my father. He came from so and so. This is such and such. This is, you know, the depth of your stories, wherever that line reaches back to, and whatever your ancestral lands might be, and how it is that you've arrived in this place matters. And whether you're going to bounce from this place and go to another place, it's not the point. Who you are inside yourself and how you came to be is all of that.
Mm.
And I don't know that in this country, and in fact many countries, other countries I've been to, especially Western countries, that society and the people within their own societies have been encouraged to celebrate who they are and their diversity and the incredibleness that is their story.
That's right.
That's a word, isn't it?
Incredible. It is. Incredibleness. It's a word now. I think part of what's at stake, what's underlying, what you're saying, is this idea that that somebody else's story can be more important than someone else's.
Yeah.
And so what it results in is a feeling that that I just want to listen to the stories of people who have real experiences.
Yeah.
Okay? So a real story is an Aboriginal story. A real story is an African story. A white story, whatever that means, is not a story. And that, of course, holds a certain kind of power to it, doesn't it?
Can do. That's right.
It can do. Yeah. And so I want us to, I want you to reflect on this idea that we talked about again before about the extraction of stories and the kinds of stories that you think people want to listen to versus the kinds of stories that you're interested in telling.
Coming back from the UK was probably, that was my biggest point. I think so much of how people are conditioned by, conditioned about us as a product, actually. It essentially is what we're talking about. If you're in this country and you want to have a real Aboriginal experience and you want to get it off the shelf and you want to actually be able to go out and experience it, I actually still meet people today who expect that I can take them out and drive them to a place just outside of the city so that they can sit around a fire and they're going to meet people who will put boomerangs and spears on the ground and do a dance for them. And they're Australians today. I meet people who are sent here or come here to this country who are being sold that as a product overseas. They're given a brochure and told that when you go to Fremantle, you'll be able to go and meet real Aborigines. And they'll do their dance for you, and it's an amazing thing. Look out for that. Yes. And when they meet me and they see me in one of these shirts, and I'm not quite that dark as they've been led to believe, they don't understand that actually all of us, we're today people too. They're sold yesterday's people. They're sold yesterday's business. And somehow our society maintains a notion of yesterday's news and told that that's how we should be measured. And actually, it's not. We're all today's people. If we were all of us to go back to our ancestral lines and someone expected that sort of experience in your house, by crikey, we'd be going right back. Get your rocks out and bits out, folks, because that's where we're going back to our fires. That's not how we live. We are today's people, and we live in a mixed up and jumbled today's society.
And so part of what you talked about in your story is this this experience of growing up in a segregated Australia. And part of what I think is so interesting about your approach to storytelling is that it helps to make sense of this jumbled up thing that we are living in the now, that storytelling is important because, of course, there are people who still live in a particular kind of way, and there are people who don't, but that what all of us are seeking often is this way to make sense of things, and that's what stories do. Are people surprised when you talk about segregation? I mean, you didn't use the term, but that's what...
That's what it was.
That's what it was. Are people surprised when you talk about, in your life, having had that institutionalized experience? And if they are, why do you think that is the case?
People are definitely surprised. I mean, even up till about the age of 10, we still had reserves where Aboriginal people lived outside of certain towns and places that, you know, people, unless you're my age or older, might not remember. But it wasn't, it was something that was also the nature of control. We're talking about, in this country, we're talking about 3% of the population. 3% of the population are Aboriginal people. It was even less back then. It's managed to have grown and thrive a little bit since as a result of, you know, better conditions. But those people were sitting on the... You know, there was actually a term at the time, and it was a movie in the 80s, wasn't there? 80s or 70s, the Fringe Dwellers. It was very much what Aboriginal people were done, especially here in Western Australia. It was based on Fringe Dwellers on communities in Western Australia and pastoral leases. The nature of how Aboriginal people were valued in and amongst a West Australian community, you know, vastly different and poked to the side.
Mm.
And very clear laws actually made sure that never the two would meet. But young people, certainly are shocked by that.
Mm.
But, you know, there's a whole swag of things that young people should be shocked about.
Mm. Mm.
Younger people should be shocked about in our world. But people are starting to grab hold of that now and make that part of their business. And that's why our stories matter, because we can actually carry the truth together a darn sight better than we can apart. And we can do something about that for our future.
Mm.
As long as we're willing to pick it up and not put it down and ignore it.
Yeah. I want to open it up for questions.
Yeah, please. Quick, put me on the spot, you mob.
Did your dad learn to speak the language when he went, was going into the reserves to teach? Or did they all kind of speak English?
All made to speak English then. And at 19, he didn't really have any sense for it. But later on, yeah, he learned language from my mum. But that was tough to do. My mum, sorry, and what I didn't say for my mum was taken when she was five. She was taken and put and kept in an orphanage in Broomtown because she was too dark to be sent down to Sister Kate's here in Perth, where she would have been trained up and then, you know, orphaned out to a non-Aboriginal family. But by then, she'd already been forced to learn English. In fact, there was a in the orphanage, there was a little tin hut that if you spoke language and misbehaved, if you went back in any language, you were jammed inside the hut and left in there for a whole day to cook. And then you pulled out and put back in there again if you hadn't learnt your lesson. My mum remembers that hut quite well, quite, unfortunately. So she was so traumatised by her own the use of her own language that she refused to teach us and wouldn't teach him. Others had to teach my father how to speak certain bits of language, but my mother still remembers how to speak. And in fact, it's only been in the last 5 years that the walls have gotten really thin, you know, in her trauma, and suddenly language comes back out. So my father's picked up bits, and across all the different Aboriginal communities he works with as well. So my father made space for that to be a part of his business and part of it, and he honoured others in their space.
A good reminder of how painful the question of language is, even as we talk story. Language is such a painful thing in this country. I work with a young woman who's a Noongar woman, Kylie Farmer.
Yes.
And she's a champion of language, but she always cautions us in the office because she's been teaching us some words, and she says, be very respectful about how and where you choose to use language, because not everyone has an easy history and relationship with these words. Good reminder of that.
I'm a storyteller as well, but I found, and I'm exactly that white person that you talk about that has problems sharing their stories, and I found it really interesting to hear that from a different angle, because I think about storytelling, particularly when it's personal, like the story that you've just told, Ron, it's you have to have great vulnerability to tell those stories. And I think sometimes, as you know, a white person who's had it very easy and not had to be vulnerable a lot, that we kind of lack the strength to tell those stories. And I sometimes wonder when other people who have had much more difficult life, or you know, particularly with racism and things like that, where you find the strength to have that vulnerability and tell those stories.
Yeah, I think people are incredible. And look, you know, the nature of trauma, the nature of experience, as you know, as being stepped upon as the other, whatever that might be, by somebody else, it's a horrific experience. And we've all got something somewhere tucked away that some of us have had the ability, amazing ability and resilience to be able to deal with at the time and bounce and move on. And some of us haven't. What I find with people who actually tip into the bravery, I guess, required to share, to make themselves vulnerable, to share a true story. And it can be a remarkably simple story. It could be just about a pair of socks and how one got lost and suddenly something comes out. Because you've suddenly opened up a space inside yourself that let others in. That vulnerability, I made a conscious decision that in order for me to be able to do what I do and help, I guess, us have better conversations about who we are as Australians, who we are in this place, was to make myself vulnerable and open the floor for that kind of conversation. But yeah, it's not something that's easily done.
No, I imagine it's it takes determination and strength and persistence.
makes you bald too. No, no, sorry.
I think, to speak to your question though, part of what's at stake is reciprocity.
Yeah.
I never say that word properly.
Yeah.
And so the sharedness is actually a crucial part of storytelling. So when I introduce Ron as a storyteller, I also introduce him as a listener.
Yeah. I did notice that. And I mean, personally for myself, I've just taken very small steps by sharing with people I'm very close with.
It's it's a work in progress. It's a work in progress. I often like to think about it as the difference. We do this when we do our storytelling here at the Center for Stories. The difference between vulnerability and exposure.
Yeah.
Okay.
So when you're vulnerable, it's hard, and you might get a little teary, or there may be some things that feel like, you know. But you can do it because there's something in the environment that feels safe and that you are held. And if it's exposure, then you really care what the consequences are and you feel naked.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like people to operate within the zone of vulnerability, but not the zone of exposure. And that if you feel that a story you're going to share or something that you are going to do is going to make you exposed, then my caution as a storyteller, as a trainer, is always to be faithful to you. The storyteller, you're the person who has to continue to live. You'll tell that story another day, right? So not to push ourselves to be exposed, but that vulnerability is actually quite a beautiful thing because it allows for some level of the word that I never know how to say. Other questions, comments, things to...
Oh, don't tell me that. You had to. Please go.
I have a question. I don't know if this is maybe too raw, but in terms of intergenerational trauma and being so conscious of your mother's experience particularly, and related to that question of vulnerability versus exposure, I'm wondering if you'd be comfortable sharing a bit about how you navigate your personal experience of trauma and intergenerational trauma and not pushing it too far. To be exposed and harming yourself and taking care of yourself.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting journey. I mean, one of the things that you might not realise is my mother didn't realise there was a law enacted that had her removed as a child from her family. I didn't realise that there were things in place that actually made that happen and occur in our state. I didn't realise that there were such things that separated Aboriginal people from non-Aboriginal people actually, you know, out there and enforced in our society that actually made this the way it was. It was just part of the life that I lived and breathed.
Mm.
My mother was extremely lucky in the sense that because she was too dark, she was kept in Broomtown. And she was used as a domestic to pick up for others and look after the world to do, mostly the church. She was strong enough inside of herself to be able to keep herself as safe as she possibly could in that environment. But my mother still struggles with certain aspects of it. And they become all the more apparent when either certain... at the time certain men would appear in our lives. For example, 1975 was when the segregation of the school stopped. 75, 76, one of those two. However, because my mother had been controlled and taken away by the church, we moved from... I was born in Northampton. We were born away from our Aboriginal family. We followed my father in his postings as a school teacher. We lived in Geraldton. Right up until 1983, every month a church official would turn up at our house and inspect the house. So it was either a senior nun, one of the senior sisters, or a senior priest, because they would go back and forth up and down between the Kimberley diocese and the diocese down here. And as they did so, they would check up on all the families that they were monitoring who were removed to those times as part of their follow-up processes. Once a month, this is our family home. This had nothing. This wasn't a government, a Giha house or a government employee house or anything like that, or a state housing house. This is their own house. They just got their first mortgage. Mm. Right up until I was 15 every month. So whenever that person arrived, my mum would get a phone call and she would just go into little girl mode and she would clean the house like a mad thing. And then we would have to wear our best clothes and we would have to sit in one space because it was the only way the particular priest that used to visit regularly was also known to be a particular priest that liked the company of little boys. And the only way my mother could protect us was to keep us in one space and not let him have any time with us alone in any space. And about the time I hit 15, after the last, you know, come over here so I can give you a hug moment, I just looked at him and said, no. And then I looked at my mother and I said, why is this man in our house? Why does this man come here and do this every time? Why? I couldn't understand my mum's helplessness, and I couldn't understand who my mother would become when these people came into that space. But something snapped in my mother and that person dropped away. Mm. And that moment, that was gone. And that was the very first time I ever saw my mother claim back some of her own fierceness. And she kicked the bugger out of the house. Mm. And it was a beautiful thing. Because they had terrorised us right up for 15 years, followed us around. My father knew none of this, by the way. These guys always picked a moment when my father was never in the house. And my mother, because she had been conditioned to such a degree that that was what was expected of her, never told him. Because he was another white man.
Yeah.
And she was taught how to keep a house.
Yeah.
But not necessarily keep a family together.
Mm.
That's the nature of the stories that are tucked away and around a lot of what it is that we're experiencing. And my story is nothing compared to... nothing, I shouldn't say that. I don't mean to say that. But the Noongar people of the Southwest, their trauma was first in this state. Kimberley, how the Kimberley was impacted upon was nothing compared to what happened in Noongar Budja, the place that we call home.
Mm.
So catching those stories, yeah. And that's one of our biggest struggles at the moment. Our biggest struggles is how do you stop the trauma from going to the next generation? And there's, you know, this is a world problem as well, but I've made a very real point inside myself to not make that stuff my son's. And my mother did that for us too. But it's so hard to do.
Mm.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't know what I got there at all. Sorry about that.
So, hi, I'm Mark Lowe. I work as an electrician and I...
good trade, that.
I work with a lot of apartment communities, housing. I just wonder if there's anything you could say to help... me connect a bit more with Aboriginal people, if that's not too much of an ask of yourself.
Well, let me first say I'm also an electrician. That's what I trained in my trade before I went away to the army and went away because the building industry fell over in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
We spoke about this inside. Really, it was actually allowing a moment each time you actually meet somebody for you to share each other's stories and generally genuinely wanting to actually hear what that other person's story is. Perhaps not trying to drag it out and pull it out of somebody, which sometimes happens. I've had people grill me, like, oh, you know, I'm getting ready for 60 minutes or something like that. And they're just trying to pull stuff out of me to suit whatever it is agenda that they're swinging off for that particular time. But actually somebody stopping, sitting and saying, g'day, I'm so-and-so. What's your story? Oh, my family come from such and such. This is my circumstance. This is so-and-so. And letting us just be people together rather than buying into whatever it is that has actually set up a situation that says, well, that's them this is us. Because 9 times out of 10, wherever I've been in the world and I've stopped and made a moment with others, and I might not even necessarily speak their language, but I've generally sat down and gone, oh, g'day. I'm Ron. Who are you? I've actually been able to have some of the most incredible conversations with people that I'm just most thankful for. Mm. We are all today's people. Maybe that's where we should start. Mm. Yeah.
I think the desire for connection is the first step.
Yeah.
So you're already doing a lot in that. I was telling Ron the story about sitting in that room next door, and I was doing a storytelling project with the Community Arts Network, and what we had to do was we had been commissioned to work with Noongar elders who had done a piece of art and to help them tell that then story of how that art was made orally. And so I was supposed to be the trainer. So I'm like, what am I going to teach a Noongar elder about telling stories? Like, this is a little bit ridiculous, right? And so I was kind of freaking out, and we had just arrived. I'd just been living in Perth for like a year and a half or something, and hadn't really had a lot of interaction with any Noongar people, and certainly not very many Aboriginal people. And so everyone was telling me, don't look him in the eyes, and like all the hocus pocus, you know, stuff that we tell one another about other people, right? And so there was all this stuff about like, be respectful and do this, and you know, so I was like really nervous. And we sat in that room over there, and Uncle Joe walked in, who we then subsequently became great mates in this process of the storytelling process. And he sat in a chair, and he was looking out across to this parking lot area, and he kept looking out the window, and I was sitting across from him, and I was like, oh, this is the no eye contact thing. You know, the narrative is like in my head. And I'm like, okay, so I'm like looking around. It's like very, very awkward. And he keeps looking out the window, and eventually he like looks across at me and he goes, see that parking lot over there? And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, that's where I had my first homosexual experience. So whatever story you think somebody is going to tell you, just forget about it, right?
Likely they just won't.
Right? No matter how many times you... Yeah. Right, Ron? This is the thing about storytelling. Like, if you just listen for long enough, someone will tell you something that is completely contrary to...
to what we've been led to believe, you know? And we all want to connect predominantly on some human level with each other. In fact, the Shire of Ravensthorpe at the moment has been going through a really difficult process of trying to actually bring out the real story of the massacre that was down there that no one talks about. And they're going through some incredibly difficult times having that conversation, but they've actually gotten along a way that people wouldn't have expected, because people have sat down and made space for people to properly share and tip into the story and hear the truth of it and let it sit and occupy a space and let it be a story for everyone who sits there, because this is the nature of the country that we live in. I think Paul Keating probably got it the best out at Redfern that time. This is all our business. But certainly be able to make yourself available rather than arrive and not, which is what often happens with contractors and other odds and sods being pushed into a place and then brought out again. You're there to do a job, don't bother me. Making time to have that conversation and letting things happen. So there's no way you would have known I was an electrician. But then I wouldn't have known you were as well. So amazing what you can learn when you stop and properly listen.
If there's no other questions, I feel like that's a pretty incredible place to end. There was something that you said, Ron, that I thought was so powerful. You talked about when you were telling the story about your mother not realizing that there was a law that had forced her away from her mother, and it was in response to this question about trauma. And it's like, it was such a beautiful way of expressing this idea that stories are in fact the thing that helps us frame our experiences. Like, that if nobody tells this country stories about the very difficult things, then we think that people are acting in crazy ways, yeah. Whereas they're only acting in the ways that have been prescribed by their experiences.
Absolutely.
So that's, you're doing the work of healing trauma in the most incredible way. So
I need all the help we can get. There's only 3% of us left in this country.
Yeah.
You think we can carry all the stories of this place by ourselves?
It's all our business.
It's all our business.
Thank you, Ron.